You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Phil Smith. He's talking to me from Exeter in England. Phil, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's a pleasure.
Phil, let's talk about what you're working on now. I don't know if you're working on multiple things, but just to get into what it is that you're doing now.
Sure. Over a month ago, I think, I published a new book, which is called Anywhere. And the book is really the culmination of almost 20 years of work, of walking in a particular area in the West Country of England, in the county of Devon. But it's actually a relatively small section of that county. And I've been repeatedly sort of visiting it really over the last sort of 20 years. And I've always wanted to write something in depth about it. So to scroll things back, in 2010, I published a book which was called Mythogeography, which was a fanciful but theoretical explanation of the kind of the way that my work had developed. It came out of my work came out of theatre, but site specific theatre and performance, and that then morphed into walking, basically the part of site specific theatre that I most loved was actually the initial searching for the sites themselves, and so I kind of increasingly dropped the end performance and simply expanded the searching and looking and exploring side of it. And in the Mythogeography book, so published 7 years ago, I tried to explain the kind of ideas that were behind that walking practice, and it also serves as a kind of handbook as well for people to make their own walking and to make their own explorations of a very, in many cases, a very ordinary places, and also sort of set out to articulate some of the traditions that comes from, both fairly traditional, so the kind of romantic walking traditions, but also some of the more radical the situationist tradition of the Derive and so on.
I mean, it's also, of course, through the lens of an artist. There's traditions of walking and thinkers and writers, and you know, or maybe like being in a cabin like Thoreau, being somewhere else. But of course, you're photographing and filming and writing as
absolutely, yeah.
As an artist, but the mythogeography word is what seems to make like this book and this title distinctive. How does could you just tell us a little bit more about why the choice of that word and what that means as an artist?
Yeah. So I mean, it springs from essentially using the ideas of psychogeography, which initially came out of the Situationist movement, predominantly in Paris in the 1950s and 1960s, and they had this practice of dérive, which was a sort of a walking without destination in the city, but in a free-flowing way in which you attempt, if you like, to undermine the policings of everyday life and avoid its structures and remake the city just by using it in a very, very simple way. That got kind of transformed, particularly in England, and it was given a sort of occult spin particularly by writers who started using the practice of kind of exploring space in that way, but then wrote it up as almost an extension of the English eerie tradition, this kind of the writings about the supernatural. quite at odds with the original meaning. So when I and sort of fellow local artists began to use this or use these techniques, we wanted to both to identify and to distance ourselves from the practice and the ideas of psychogeography in its different forms. And we added to it a much more fanciful kind of approach. So the occult psychogeographers, although they are fanciful in the sense that they might evoke supernatural things, to be honest, it's all rather sincere. And so our idea was to bring a much lighter touch, but at the same time retain the politics of the situationists that has sort of disappeared out of the practice, or to some extent anyway, out of the practice of the occult psychogeographers. So mythogeography became a term which initially we sort of used almost accidentally, but then became very useful as a way to distinguish ourselves from other practices, which we're kind of quite close to, but not identical to. And the thing that probably characterizes and differentiates mythogeography is probably the principle of multiplicity, that it's very much about the multiplicity of any space. So it wouldn't, for example, have much sympathy with Auger's ideas of non-places, that even in homogenized or apparently homogenized spaces, if you are willing to look closely and deeply enough, you will find the eccentricities, and you'll find the eccentrics there. You'll find the people who are using it and using those spaces kind of against the rules of their uses.
And when you compare it to psychogeography, you mentioned that often incorporated the supernatural. Would mythogeography and in your book also touch on, or your experiences, the supernatural, which I mean, I'm not even sure how to define that. Is that ghost? What is that?
A perennial problem, isn't it? I mean, absolutely. But what we what differentiates mythogeography is that it doesn't privilege one of these layers or one of these discourses above the others. So whereas in occult psychogeography, in the end, behind the space is some sort of occult force which is creating an identity for that space, whereas for mythogeography there are always multiple identities for any space, which might be there will be at all sorts of different levels, and there may well be beliefs about that space which are religious, supernatural. There may be all sorts of legends, and there may be all sorts of urban myths that are related to a particular place. And there will be many other layers which one would give just as much importance to, that might be seen as more mundane, for example, industrial narratives. There may be narratives, geological, all sorts of different climatic narratives, which mythogeography gives equal standing to. It's not looking for one single kind of driver to the identity of a space, but actually seeking to set as many of those layers in motion around each other as possible. And really, it's the characterization of a space through mythogeography is looking at the way that those different layers move in relation to each other.
And those layers, since I was talking about the supernatural, would that be part of it? Is that how you're defining it?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, yeah. So there may well be in a space, may well find that people are narrating it in some sort of supernatural narrative. So, I mean, that this will kind of interconnect with all sorts of popular cultural narratives as well, you know. So So I recently attempted to get access to some caves in a local village, which was, and this was made up part of this book anywhere. And in one of these caves, there is documented evidence of a chapel which is certainly of medieval origins and maybe earlier, which appears to have been destroyed on purpose. And the thinking is that it may have been the site for some sort of informal, unofficial worship. Now, when we turned up at the village trying to get access to these caves, because they're on somebody's farm, so we went to the local pub to track down the farmer, explain what we were up to, and immediately you sort of open up the layers. So one person in the pub is trying to tell us that the cave is actually an entrance to an enormous tunnel that comes out sort of 5 or 6 miles away in this cave system that's very famous. Somebody else kind of thinks that this has a resonance with Game of Thrones, and they start reciting to us various kind of narratives from the television series. You know, so the moment that you begin to interrogate what the meaning is, you're immediately kind of getting these different layers and these different levels and these different narratives. And whereas in many people's approaches to the identity or the meaning of a place would be to discriminate one against the other. So, well, we're not going to take any notice of this thing about the tunnels, you know, because it's clearly not true, and it's a story that people tell you about multiple places. Or we're not going to take notice of the fact that somebody's starting to reference a television series which doesn't have any connection to this place. Rather, what we say is that each of these things has relevance to that place, as does the documented history of it, and that what is forming that place, so to speak, is the way that all those different kinds of informations and materials move around each other and how they relate to each other, and that is always different wherever you are. Those relations are always different.
That's true, and that's a wonderful story about going into the pub and asking that, and you know, that's also really part of the research, you know, talking to people and discussing that and deciding how you're going to move forward.
Absolutely.
So, absolutely.
So, I mean, they then, you know, as so often happens, when you call on local expertise, it's very often hopeless. So they send us to the wrong bit of the farm to find the farmer, you know. So there is a sort of, there's a kind of authenticity, but it's often the wrong authenticity. It's often a skewed and mistaken authenticity. But absolutely to engage with it and not to find those mistakes and those not knowings to be important as well. So when we raised the question of the caves in the pub, some people were very familiar with the story and some people had never heard of it before and were staggered that something so extraordinary, because it's not just the story of the chapel, that a guy in the middle of the 19th century from the village sort of retired into poverty in order to work every day in those caves and brought out, I think, 900 sets of hyena's teeth and so many bones of reindeer and all sorts of extraordinary animals, wolves, which is how he got into the Game of Thrones, that they filled his entire cottage. His whole cottage was like an ancient ossuary. And he didn't tell anybody he was doing it. He just did it secretly. And eventually he went to some let's call them legitimate archaeologists and paleontologists, And they would have nothing to do with him because he was his whole project was to prove that the timeline of the Bible was correct. And they just spent their entire lives proving the opposite. So he went to the wrong people, and so eventually all his stuff is now in a museum. But as I say, some people in the pub were completely unaware that this extraordinary kind of project was happening, and what, about 100 yards from the pub.
Fantastic, really. I'm so glad you told that story. That's curious things you find and dig up.
Yeah, but what's extraordinary is it seems to happen kind of every walk, that there's something like that's turned up, and it's not necessarily something that happened 150 years ago. It might be discovering something that happened the week before. And it's not always kind of happy strangeness. It can be very unhappy strangeness. So as part of the walking that I did for the Anywhere book, I came to a headland which has a or normally has a metal fence around the top of the headland, and there was a huge section missing. And I spoke to somebody, and somebody had driven over it on purpose and ended their life on the cliffs in their car. And you're constantly coming every day up against the extraordinary. And it was particularly extraordinary at that spot because it's a sort of tragic spot. It's a spot where a lot of local men had actually blown themselves up during the Second World War, not during any fighting, but during a demonstration of firing a battery gun, and something had gone wrong, and the charge went off inside the barrel, and a lot of deaths occurred. So there's a sort of I don't attribute these things to sort of supernatural or anything, but you do get the sense that occasionally certain things are attracted to certain spaces, that certain spaces kind of produce things. And over the walking period that I did for the Anywhere book, although it draws on like 20 years of walking, I was walking sporadically over about, I think, 2 months. And in that time, as well as the guy who drove his car over the cliffs, 4 other bodies washed up on that bit of shoreline that I was walking, all middle-aged men and all suicides. And when you see that kind of pattern happening, then you realize that there's something seriously gone wrong in that society, that something awful is happening. And in fact, I did have to deal at one point with someone who was suicidal, which fortunately I think we managed to get them into the right sort of hands and with the right sort of help. But that's kind of part of the practice, in a way. Is I would call it putting yourself at the mercy of the road, so that you have to be sort of open to these things happening, and to notice more than you would normally notice. And sometimes it's very clearly an aesthetic connection, and sometimes it's an ethical one.
Well, that also sounds, it's another level of research, the idea of, chronic suicides and something going on in the town. I mean, did that point to anything particular? That's a quite different kind of research, but also very disturbing to see a pattern of that in a town. Why would that happen in a town? Did you have any idea of why that would happen?
Well, I was the particular area I was in was a part of the coastline where the towns had been fairly thriving sort of seaside holiday resorts. And really, for a generation or so now, they've been in decline to some degree, and in some cases the decline has been very severe. And so there's a sort of sense, I think, in some of the towns that they don't really know what they're there for anymore. And this would not be the whole town, but there would be sets of people in those towns who thought they knew what they were growing up in, and find that that place sort of has disappeared, and that it's changed. And I think in those circumstances, when people find it very hard to adapt to changes that are not positive for them, then yeah, sometimes a kind of hopelessness can kick in. And in some of those places, the kind of the live culture has in some ways also declined. So if you're not someone who gets their enjoyment through virtual space and technology and electronic entertainment, then for some people the social camaraderie, the social connections that were in those places are not as intense and as supportive as they were. Why people make those individual decisions are undoubtedly individual and very hard to explain. But one sees, you know, you can see certain patterns. You feel the atmosphere. I mean, that's one of the other things that this practice very much takes from the Situationists, is the idea of ambiance or atmosphere. And it's being sensitive to feeling the way that the atmosphere changes. So in a couple of those towns, I definitely had a feeling of aggression, violence, despair. Only just in little sort of patches, little areas, get a very strong sense of that, and then very different feelings elsewhere in the town. But being sensitive to those changes of atmosphere, those sudden changes of ambiance, is very much what the practice is about.
It's fascinating, and it sounds quite profound, really, the full scope of the experience and venture and book and its implications, both socially. I mean, it seems to really extend beyond this idea of mythogeography.
Yeah.
It's encompassing quite a lot.
Yeah, and the next thing that I'm working on is to prepare a talk for a gathering of like-minded souls up in the north of England in September, so next month, about 2 or 3 weeks now, and in that, what I'm going to be proposing in the talk that I've been asked to give is what I'm calling revolutionary pilgrimage. So almost a sort of anti-pilgrimage. So it's not a pilgrimage to anywhere, but it's kind of learning how to be and there's no religious aspect to this. Well, I suppose there could be if you chose to make it so, but for me there isn't. But it's learning how to conduct a pilgrimage in your everyday life. So in the chances that you get to sort of break away and have the kind of mission or quest that a pilgrimage has, and to adopt some of the details of that pilgrimage, or pilgrim practices, but to very much do it in the weft and warp of everyday life, so that you can, what's the word? Sort of, you know, tiptoeing through the raindrops. This is actually very much kind of walking in plain sight in your own sort of space of pilgrimage. So there is, within the mythogeography, I'm hoping to kind of extend it. And what it's about, really, in many ways, is kind of resisting what the Situationists would have called the spectacle, resisting the spectacle of images, the plethora of communication, and the sound, the noise of non-communication. But it's also about resisting the way that now the spectacle comes after us. So, you know, that when we engage in virtual space, and I'm a big user of virtual space, it comes back at us. The algorithms are set loose on us to find out what our predilections are and what our tendencies may be. And this pilgrimage is very much about creating a space which is free of all that.
I love that, and it sounds like the lecture and what comes after that is almost a form of collaboration, because other people could be is how I interpret part of what you just said. Other people could be using these tools as techniques.
Oh, absolutely! That's entirely what my work is about. Is about creating tools and techniques and ideas for other people to use. Yeah, totally.
Well, it's very exciting to talk to you. Before we go, I want to ask you what it is that you're reading at the moment.
Okay, all right. So I'm in the middle of a graphic novel, which is called The Theory of the Grain of Sand, which is part of a series called the Obscure Cities series. And it's set in a sort of steampunk futuristic city in which various strange things have occurred. So one of the things just seem to appear at places. So there's a guy who has a flat, and in his flat, every time he turns round, a white rock appears, and then another white rock, until his flat he's continually having to sort of clear the rocks out of the flat and into the street, and they're trying to work out kind of what is happening. Whereas in the cafe next door, the chef, who was a very big man, has become incredibly light, and so light that he's starting to float a few inches off the ground. So I've no idea why or any of this is happening, or whether I'm going to find out by the end of the novel. But I'm enjoying it, and it's beautifully, beautifully drawn. So yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today and your work. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. It's good to talk to you, Ben.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.